Anthony Doyle is a prisoner in Texas. If this faith has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas. Death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison staff is preparing to put Anthony Doyle to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will broadcast live coverage of the killing in Texas, the state responsible for more than a third of all U.S. executions. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, legal analyst Jim Skelton, with criminal defense attorneys Larry Douglas, Mike Gillespie, and Jack Lee. Huntsville reporter outside the death house, Kelly Epstein. Houston Vigil reporter, Dave Atwood. Tonight's featured guest is Dwayne Bennett, an advocate for death row prisoners. The Execution Watch for Anthony Doyle begins.
Good evening. This is Ray Hill, and welcome to Execution Watch. We've got a, before we get into the sad business of tonight, we've got a couple of announcements to make this afternoon. A court-ordered Texas Department of Criminal Justice to reveal to the attorneys representing two people pending execution to this point the source of the execution drugs that will be used in their execution. That release was released to them in camera, so they can't share that with anyone else at this time. But it was necessary for the people they represent to know for sure that whoever was concocting these deadly drugs knew enough about what they're doing to prevent unnecessary suffering in the process. That just happened this afternoon. And in addition to that, those of you who follow Execution Watch on executionwatch.org should check it out, because the videos that we have been promising for some time are now linked to the cases where we do have videos, and we have videos for Execution Watch whenever the producer, Elizabeth Stein, myself, and Mark Pirtle go to death row and actually interview the inmates that are scheduled to be executed. And when we do that show, that video interview is part of the story. And that is not only available on the website, but it's soon after that execution, the show is shown on Houston Media Source. I want to thank Mark Pirtle for the extra duty on that, and, of course, the cooperation of Elizabeth Stein. We have somebody on the line from Huntsville. Let's see if Kelly, is it Kelly Epstein?
Yes, it is, Ray. How are you?
Well, I am well. What's going on up there, Kelly?
Well, the media witnesses just went in about 2 minutes ago. We haven't seen another group. We don't know if any family members are up here to witness or not. They may be going in shortly. If not, we just assume that there were no family members. There's about 13 of us up here. We have a visitor from Netherlands, one from Belgium, and one from England, and a couple of students.
Well, I think I want to thank you for being up there and helping the prison show, Execution Watch, cover the event. I'll explain to the audience that when the media witnesses crosses the road, that means to us that the process has begun. And it will continue then until Mr. Doyle is dead. Anthony Doyle was a young man when he was convicted of this crime, and I'm surprised there are no family there.
They may still be going in, Ray, but as of right now, we do not think any of them have gone in.
Kelly, give our regards to the vigilance there, and you'll call us back when something happens.
Thank you. I'll do that, Ray. Bye.
Bye. And that's Kelly Epstein. She's helping us with coverage of the Huntsville scene. Is Dave on the line? Dave, this is Ray. Where are you? Dave? Dave? I think we lost Dave. Sound like a click buzz to me. I can tell you where Dave is. Dave is at the University of Houston. They're having a lecture this evening about executions there, and so Dave is over there at the University of Houston. They decided to just hold the vigil at the place of the rally and the lecture, and that's as good as anywhere. Expose the student at University of Houston as they pass going to evening classes with a vigil opposed to execution. And I can tell you at this moment, producer Elizabeth Stein is trying to find Dave. Dave, she's got him on the phone, so it'll be just a second. I know, Dave, are you there?
I'm here.
And I've already told the people the folks there were at the University of Houston.
Right. We're here, and we just moved over from, we had a vigil at what's called Butler Square, which is like a free speech area on campus, and we've now moved over to the Parish Hall for the program tonight, the panel discussion they're going to have on the death penalty.
Tell us about that.
Well, it's going to be, they've got about five people on the panel, a very diverse group of people, I might say, and people from our organization, Gloria's there for the Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement, Nicole Caceres from the University of St. Thomas, she's an attorney that defended Anthony Graves, Angel Adams with the TCADP, and Pat Monks, who is with the TCADP, but he's a libertarian. So we've got a mix over here of people who are, I guess you'd call progressives, and we've got a group that are libertarians. So it's a very interesting mix of people.
Well, either end of the spectrum come to the same point on executions and big government issues.
Right, right, and that's why we're together tonight, which is a movement in the right direction.
Well, enjoy the presentation tonight. We've heard from Kelly Epstein, who is also with Texas Coalition to abolish the death penalty.
Right.
And
right.
She reports that the witnesses have crossed the road, so unfortunately Mr. Doyle is headed for the rest of the procedure.
Yep. Okay. Well, that's too bad, but this is Texas, right? Unfortunate.
Give our regards to mutual friends there at the lecture, and we'll talk to you later, Dave.
Okay, Ray. Thank you. You take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Dave Atwood with the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. Jim, what happened in this case?
Pretty short and simple. What happened is that Anthony Doyle was 18 and just turned 19 and ordered some donuts from a donut shop, disguising his voice as a woman. And a female 37-year-old woman delivered the donuts, and he beat her to death with a baseball bat. And after he did so, he then, at that point, tried to wash some of the blood up. Then he took her cell phone, her car, some credit cards, and went over to some friend's house and foolishly told them what he had done, said he really meant business. Then they tried to use some of the credit cards after the death, after the murder, immediately afterwards. The opinions don't say, but the police found out about it. Since they found out about it, his mother tried to get him to go confess or talk to the police, and he wouldn't do it. So finally, he ends up being picked up by the police after warrants issued. He gives an oral confession admitting all of it, and that was followed by a 10-page confession just laying out the details of the murder. So during the guilt-innocence part of the trial, there wasn't a whole lot to dispute because they went back to the apartment where the killing occurred and found he tried to wash the blood off. They found a lot of her clothing and found a receipt for the donuts that he had ordered. So there never was a question about guilt in this case. And what's kind of unique and unusual in the punishment evidence, there was absolutely nothing by way of a prior conviction. There was some evidence that at school he'd had violent outbursts of temper. There was also some mitigating evidence that he had a deprived childhood. And he had spent 2 years in Texas in a boot camp on these Texas youth boot camps, and apparently somebody from that group said it didn't do him any good. Then they had a psychologist who testified that they had a normal IQ, so there never was a question about any sort of mental impairment or being mentally ill. And they gave him the death penalty, I think primarily because it was a rather brutal killing of a woman with a baseball bat.
And where did this happen?
Dallas County.
There wasn't much for the lawyer to do.
No, there was not. In this case, on the fact part, there's not a whole lot to do because, and I think if this was tried today in today's current climate, they would never have sought the death penalty. And this case is one of those cases we've talked about before that, because back then, you know, you had a kind of as a new toy the prosecutors were playing with, and they did a whole bunch of that. If they didn't, they wouldn't have sought the death penalty.
This would have been a Henry Wade case?
I know it was after Henry Wade. It was before the new DA got in, the one that's exonerated so many people.
Before Watson.
Before Watson arrived. And back then, there were a lot of these counties were doing death penalty cases until the county commissioners realized how much it cost them. They started backing off from them. And we talked about that before. Up in Hempstead, they say that we can buy a new maintainer when it talks to try a death penalty case. We'd rather have a new maintainer. We ain't going to do death penalty cases. Mm-hmm. So this today, they would not, in my opinion, they would never have tried this as a death penalty case because of the cost of having to go through all the trials.
Even a case where they don't cut down a lot of trees, and this is one of those cases.
Boy, this got one of the, we talk about a fast track. It was real simple. Trial, conviction, death sentence, direct appeal affirmed, all writs denied. All of them were, in fact, every opinion in this case was an unwritten, meaning that there was nothing new or novel.
No paper.
Well, when they do an unwritten opinion, that simply means there's nothing unusual or novel about the facts or the law to justify publishing the opinion where we put in the law books.
Well, even in that fast-track circumstance, how much money got spent on this case?
Oh, my goodness. By the time they pay all the writ large and stuff, you're talking about maybe a $200,000, even on a fast track like this. And this is why, at first, they were doing a lot of in cases like this. They were doing, but then they begin to realize the tremendous cost of what it costs to do this. And they've been backing off from them a great deal because commissioner courts control the strings of the money strings of the county. They've been backing off from them.
And county taxpayers pay for that.
Right.
The state taxpayer wound up with some of it.
Absolutely.
In the federal writ series.
It's not that we become moral; we become stingy. So yeah. It's not that believe me, it's not moral.
Not
has to do with being stingy.
All right, who's going to talk about those appeals, or what are we going to talk about?
Mike's going to. The what I'd like to do, since there's not anything a whole lot to talk about, since we have so many European audiences, I thought we'd give them a preview of how death penalty cases are handled and how we select juries. Because as you said earlier, all of these cases are decided by a jury, and so I thought we'd use this as an opportunity to kind of get some information about how jurors are selected. Mike's going to talk about that, and Larry's going to talk about how they're specifically found out they're selected in a death penalty case. Then Jack's going to come along and talk about really the only two issues on jury selection were a couple of jurors that he argued on appeal that they shouldn't, that they should not have been on the panel. Mike's going to talk about that.
Okay, Mike.
We in America have a jury system. What people don't really understand is the jury system goes back to ancient times. As early as ancient Greece, there was jury systems. In ancient Germany, there was jury systems. They were a little bit different, though. What people did in those societies, they picked a few good, honest men of character and let them investigate crimes and convict the person who they thought did it. We later changed that when America came to take the power to investigate and convict from one person to separate it to the police and to the court systems. So our juries don't investigate crimes, but our juries do determine the facts of the case and determine guilt or innocence. The big difference in a jury system from the beginning of time to now is that in the old days, the jurors were juries of your peers. What that meant is they picked people from the community who knew you. And if there was a business dispute between you and a tradesman, the people who came in knew your personality and knew the tradesman work habits, and they could judge the facts based on knowledge of who you were and the kind of person you were. But that was then, and now we have now, and now we tend to bring strangers in to make judgments on people. Some people don't think that's a good idea because some people present themselves better in front of strangers and can talk better in front of strangers. Some people who are more shy and more bashful can't communicate as well. People who know that person might look at them different, but we are not now allowed to have people on a jury panel who know you. We have to deal with strangers. Some people think that juries are bad because sometimes the issues in a trial are too complex for a jury to understand. And sometimes people think that juries are bad because the elegance of an attorney can overwhelm people and make people rule out of emotion rather than facts. Well, those are true. But there are things about a jury that does overcome that. And the first thing is that juries have a thump, they have a heartbeat on the accepted values of society, and they can apply subjective tests to fact situations better than the law can. The other situation with the jury is when you have 12 people put into a room to discuss the facts, through discussion comes out introspective analysis, and through this discussion of the case, hopefully people can look at different angles of it and make good decisions. And last but not least, it's a lot easier to corrupt one judge than 12 jurors. 12 good, honest people are hard to get to corrupt. One judge might be easier to corrupt. So what we have now is a system that people come down who do not know you and they come report to jury duty. Well, there's certain exemptions from jury duty. One of the exemptions means if you have certain characteristics, you don't have to go to jury duty. Jurors are picked from a random sampling of voter registration and driver's licenses. And they have a big bingo wheel, used it now as electronically, but they pick a random amount of people to come downtown. And you have to come unless you're over 70, which means you're too old, if you have kids under 12, if you're a student, if you're a caretaker of an invalid, or in active duty for the military. If those are your qualifications, then you're exempt from jury duty. Once you get down and you want to be on jury duty, you can't always be on jury duty, even when you want to, if you're disqualified. People that are disqualified are people who have felonies in the background, have probation in the backgrounds, people who are under indictments, people on deferred adjudications, people who are not citizens of America, people who are not citizens of Harris County, and believe it or not, people that can't read or write. They cannot be on the jury. Also, you have to speak English. Once we get rid of the people who are exempt and get rid of the people who are disqualified, now we have a pool of jurors. This is a pool of jurors, or then they're sent from the jury assembly room to an individual court, where the individual courts will make individual decisions. The purpose of the jury assembly room, and for curiosity, this morning I went over there to see what it was like. Being a lawyer, I never go there, but I did today. And what I saw was the most carefully orchestrated system for getting the jurors $6 a day back
group,
to the government I ever saw in my life.
Group dancing.
Unbelievable. Yeah.
Group dancing.
Yeah.
All right, you call the names up, and y'all get over here, and then they get up, and they leave together.
And the part that gets me, just a little thing about this, what kind of people are we getting as jurors? We're getting people who take off from work to go down there to judge other people. And when they get there, they're put into a secure zone. They have to go through metal detectors. They got to be guarded by police. They're told when to go, when to stand up, when to sit down, march two by two, go to the courtroom. This is not normal behavior for people. The people that tend
that's
to go
down. It's normal behavior for convicts.
It's normal behavior for people who are not objective about breaking the law.
It kind of implies you're trying a dangerous person in a dangerous place. It's like by dangerous jurors.
Well, but even more than that, they get $6 for the first day, and anything more than that is voluntarily. They have all of these campaigns when you come in where they want you to donate the $6 to the victims of crimes.
Yeah.
What kind of...
Well, parking costs more than that.
Well, they encourage you to take the bus so they have the money for the parking. But when you want the jurors to give the money to victims of crime and ask for by the police with guns and they march you to the courthouse with the criminals or through metal detectors, it puts you into a light where you a little bit think this is serious business and you're doing society's job by helping them.
It's normal behavior for slaves.
I like this. I would like
comment, but you needed a microphone.
Repeat, Jack.
What Mike, what you're describing is proper behavior for slaves.
What I would like to see is everybody who's asked to come to jury duty come to jury duty. There is a law that says you have to come to jury duty. I have never seen a judge issue arrest warrants for people that don't come to jury duty. I think they'd be afraid to do that. I think if the people who don't want to come to jury duty were forced to come to jury duty, they might not give the same verdicts of people who are afraid of the system.
I've actually known people in El Paso County who were fined for not making it to jury duty.
This happens to be Harris County, though. I'm sorry, Jack, not here.
Yeah, they've actually gone out on the streets and picked up passing strangers.
Fred Huey used to do that a lot. They'd go out there and pick up every wino they could find and drag them in. Years ago, Ray, you never wanted to try. A jury panel lasted for a week, and you never wanted to try them toward the final part of the week because they'd sit on two jurors early and they convicted everybody. And back then, you wouldn't want to pick a jury during the bus strike because all the minorities couldn't get to town. Now that's changed, son.
In all of my reading and getting prepared for this, there's one quote I read from a Supreme Court decision I think says it best. We need to understand that the beautiful part about America is that in America, only a jury can strip a man of his life or liberty. And that is a very important thing that not everybody in the world has. The government cannot do it to you. Only other citizens can do it to you. And that is something that we tend to forget.
Well,
one of our precious rights.
One day I catch the bus a lot from the courthouse complex over to the post office. That's 66 at Yale. So I go up there, I'm waiting at the bus stop, and here's this nice lady with a walker, and she's all dressed up, and she's got her jury summons in her hand, because that means she can get on the bus for free. If it's jury day, you got a free bus ride. And I said, well, did they discharge you? She said, I never even made a panel, and I got up this morning, I was really wanting to convict somebody. And so I thought, well, maybe you're not making the panel is a good sign.
Marriage not going well.
When I was growing up, and I'm from New York City, when I was growing up, they had a different type of jury system in New York. It was a volunteer system in which they paid decent wages, and people had full-time jobs as jurors. They might be retired on pensions.
But they would be there.
They might be teachers on summer breaks or students on Easter breaks. But there'd be a lineup at the jury halls of people looking to make the $30, $35 a day that was decent money and actually be part of the system. They stopped it because it got to be, you had the same jurors for all the trials.
Well, see, Michael, that's one of the things that is bad about that system, because after you tried three or four trials, you become jaded. That's one of the problems.
There's another system they're doing now in some jurisdictions, because one of the troubles with juries on the civil side of the case is the trials can last weeks and weeks and months, and they get confused to the issues. So what some courts are doing, with permission of both counsels, is they're videotaping all the testimony, like depositions. They're then culling all the admitted evidence into a movie, picking a jury and showing them the movie in a movie theater and letting them make a verdict based on the movie. And the concept is, by culling out all the immaterial, irrelevant facts and having an edited version of what's admissible, they might
here?
Pay attention. I've seen this in Midwest states. And civil trials, complex issues that would take weeks and weeks and months to try, by agreement of counsels, they will do this to shorten it down, because they know they're going to lose the juries on complex issues after weeks at a time.
Just see going home telling you, but sometime during the credits, I voted to execute the guy.
They also, in some jurisdictions,
do they do popcorn, Michael, when they watch the movie?
In some jurisdictions, they can voluntarily.
Listen, Gladden tried to get them to
can
popcorn.
Get together and put up money and pay the jurors extra money for their services. As long as both sides paid it, it's fair. And I think that's a nice thing to do.
Point out one thing, Michael, the police testify get paid extra duty money to come down and testify. They get about three times as much as the jurors who decide. The case.
Well, yeah. That's because they have to face us. That's hazardous duty.
Okay, where do we go from Mike?
We go from there to Larry. Larry's going to talk about Captain.
While Larry's talking, could somebody get Mr. Bennett in here to replace Mike? Because I've got an interview coming up here in a few minutes.
I'll fetch.
Okay, briefly, Anthony Doyle is facing the death penalty because of a decision by a jury. And so I'm just here to talk a little bit about jury selection, especially in capital cases. Juries are selected in Texas through a process called voir dire. We select juries in both misdemeanors and non-death capital felonies and then death penalty capitals. It's probably best to understand death penalty capital by looking at just the overall jury selection process. Normally, for instance, in a misdemeanor, they would send 30 or so people over, and judge and prosecutor and defense lawyer gets to ask them questions to get them to disqualify themselves. And those who are disqualified for cause. It cannot be fair. Then each side is allowed to have peremptory challenges, that is, strikes, saying that this person, just for whatever reason you want to have a person removed, although the prosecutor cannot remove people in protected classes without having a good faith a non-discriminatory reason. They've got to be able to state those. But in a misdemeanor court, we each get three strikes, and then the first six people who remain become your jury. And both the prosecutor and defense can look at the whole panel at one time. The same happens in felony cases, except in felony cases they send over about 60 people, and we each have 10 strikes. In capital murder, they will send over hundreds of people, and the examination is done on a one-by-one basis. Misdemeanors and felonies, non-death felony capitals, we get a sheet of who the jurors are, like three per page, and gets just a thumbnail sketch on what they filled out when they sent back in the jury summons. In a capital case, they get the list 2 days in advance. And the jurors are subject to detailed questionnaires that can go on for 10, 20 pages, asking them questions about what your feelings are about prosecutors and defense lawyers, what your favorite movie is, are you a conservative or liberal, you know, all kinds of questions that the jurors, including, you know, what your background is and so forth. They have to answer those questions. And then the real critical difference, and this goes some to what Jim was talking about, the expense of a capital case. The process goes on for a long time because jurors are questioned one at a time. And so the prosecutor and the defense lawyer gets to ask them questions to see, one, whether they can be fair.
So that could take weeks.
Absolutely.
Right. We've had there's many, many instances in jury trial. You can take 8 weeks to pick a jury, and that's going 5 days a week. Mm. And that builds up for the expenses, what we talked about earlier.
It can easily take weeks. It's a draining process. The lawyers are there, and on a capital, typically capital, you've got appointed counsel. You don't have an appointed counsel. You have two appointed counsel. You've got two lawyers there that the state's paying, the county's paying. And for capital, that's the highest you pay because it's so critical because a person's life can be taken for what they're
alleged. You have to be tested and qualified for those appointments?
You have to be qualified for all of them, but the qualifications are a whole lot higher for a capital. Okay, if you're taking appointments, you've got to qualify for appointments even for misdemeanors, but it's not that strenuous test. Felonies, but also for capital, that's the highest level. So you do have to qualify and requalify on a regular basis to maintain your capital appointment qualification.
And Ray, one of the problems with that, a lot of the qualifications in Harris County is based upon trial experience. And here's one of your problems you got. Those with the most trial experience are former prosecutors.
Yeah.
And as a result of that, you end up having a weighty group of former prosecutors trying death penalty cases.
Yeah, but sometimes, you know, in the law profession, you're supposed to be able to take off one hat and put on another one. Is there a problem with that?
Yeah, Mary Poppins flies an umbrella, too. It doesn't always work that way. I hate to be that way. But.
And are there jury selection consultants?
Yes.
You can hire somebody to come in and help you with your jury selection.
If you've got the money, sure.
Well, sometimes judges will let you appoint. There have been instances where in a real serious case, they'll even have the county pay for a jury consultant.
Okay.
And that adds to the expense of
the
capital.
Oh, that's the expense, yeah.
That adds to the expense. The other big difference in the capital is that when you're talking about the capital jury selection is one at a time. Now, I mentioned that in misdemeanor court, you have three strikes. Felony court, you have 10 strikes. In capital case, you've got 15 strikes. But you've got to exercise your strikes, whether for cause or peremptory strikes, write it on a person-by-person basis. So if you've got 15 and you're getting down toward the end of the process and you've already burned it through 14, that last strike is going to be extremely important to you before you spend it. And I think Jack's going to talk about the process of asking for additional strikes.
Okay, I want the audience. Let me tell you. Hey, guys, down on the row, I know you're listening to this, and I want to be sure and get Villegas' name correct on the show. Villegas, I got your note. Thank you very much for your note. I'll remember your kids. I hope I don't have to do that show, but if I do, I'll remember what you said about your kids on that show.
Ray, one thing I'd like to do, we got a guest tonight named Sharon Cooper who's agreed to come and watch us do it, and perhaps in the future she's agreed.
She's the gal over there with the chair
exactly
and the whip.
Right.
Okay.
Over there trying to make us all behave.
That's right. Okay. That's
and
not
in the
easy.
Future, once she hears how bad we are, she's going to volunteer to kind of police
come
up.
Tidy up.
Make it, you know, give it a little bit of glamour to
tidy
it.
Tidy up. And she's from Yankee Land.
Well, no. The one she's replacing is, I can't say what I normally call this, a Yankee, but she's our throwdown Yankee lady, but she's from Texas.
Oh, she's from Texas. Mm-hmm. Okay, that helps. Okay, I've got Dwayne Bennett in the studio, and Dwayne, get up close to the microphone. I had Dwayne on the prison show some years ago, and he was the guy from Rio. And if you don't know what Rio is, it's a division of Texas workforce that finds employment for former felons after they get out of prison. And you enjoyed that, did you?
I really did. Actually, it was the very first job that I had upon finishing college, and young, and was kind of thrown into the throes of doing that type of work. Didn't really know what I was getting into, per se, and was downtown Houston on Smith Street, and I often tell people it's one of the best jobs that I've had from the perspective of helping people. And so,
well, you've got a few more gray hair now than you had then. So you've been around the block a while. That's been a bunch of years ago.
That's been a bunch of years ago. In essence, what happened is the intent of the program, from my perspective, it was a very effective program. It was to minimize recidivism. And so we came in Project Rio, and what we would do is we would see people twice a day, 30 to 40 men and women who were coming home, trying their best to do the right thing and not go back to prison. And so all day, every day, we would be down there preaching, stomping, and trying to help them find jobs. And I think we were very successful in doing that. One of the things that really brought me full circle, in essence, in trying to do this work or doing this work, while working at Project Rio, there was an instance when my grandmother was living with me. And she had had a massive heart attack.
Yeah.
And she was not supposed to live from that heart attack. She was at Herman Memorial Hospital, and the cardiologist came in and said she's not going to make it. She's in a grave state. And so in front of, I still continued to do my work. I was in grad school at the time.
Yeah.
The long story short, continued working, and I was at work one day, and here I am in front of all of these men and women. And, Ray, I broke down. I literally broke down, and I teared up. And I had to dismiss the class, and as I dismissed the class, there was one man that stayed behind, and everyone else was gone. And you know, and I know, that you don't show a sign of weakness when you're in that situation.
Well, I think that's what they train you. I don't know that I know that.
And so, well, I was taught that. And so, anyway, this gentleman stayed behind, and he asked me a very poignant and specific question. Do you have your house in order, so to speak? And I knew what he was talking about in regards to my grandmother's financial disposition, yeah, and everything. And I explained to him that it was too expensive. I was in grad school trying to take care of a son, trying to take care of my grandmother. And he said to me, quite frankly, he said, "You saved my life." Matter of factly. And I said, "Come on, give me a break." And he says, "No." He said, "Dwayne, I was a corporate attorney, got caught up with some wrong people. I didn't do what I did, but my circumstance put me in the place that I ended up." He said, "I came back into society. I had pretty much given up hope, and I was instructed to come to Project Rio." He says, "I came here. I looked straight ahead every day. I didn't want to be here." Anyway, the truth of the story was that he said he almost committed suicide. No one wanted to associate with him. And so he said, "You in this program, Project Rio," and it wasn't, I'm not the big me in this circumstance. It's about a collective group of people who cared about people who were transitioning from prison back into society, really cared about trying to make people assimilate accordingly. And so he said, "What I'll do for you is bring me as much information as you possibly can in regards to your grandmother's estate, and I'll help you."
And you trusted this man, knowing he's been to the joint.
I trusted him. I'm a God-fearing person. I didn't have anything else to lose, and quite frankly, I put my trust in his professionalism. A week or two later, he came back with all of the legal documents that were required for me to take care of my grandmother's affairs, and he said, "Do this, do that, and do this, and everything will be taken care of." His story was, he ended up getting a job. He got a nice paying job. He regained his, I guess, sense of being, per se.
Yeah.
Whereby he can go out and feel good about himself. That was one story among many in the Project Rio program. And subsequent to that, what I said, just, you know, from my standpoint, I raise money for a living. I speak to people, I talk to audiences, and I talk about the story, and I try to convey or tell that person's story from the prism of the circumstance that they're in. And I went on to go work at two different nonprofit organizations. One is well noted, raising a lot of money. And so I did that. I said, that's one of the things in life that I want to do, is raise money and give back to communities that we serve. As it would be, my life kind of turned full circle. A few years ago, I was working out in West Texas, and away from home, moved back to South Texas, Houston, and I'm from the Victoria area. And I stumbled upon persons that were incarcerated for capital offenses. And so I began reading and kind of immersing myself and trying to learn more about people's plights and predicaments and how they got into the situation, mainly because in another life I mentor youth and I'm trying to eradicate that pipeline to prison mentality. And so just wanted to kind of get a sense of what happened and how things are happening. And I was in Austin, Texas, and I'd come across the Cameron Todd Willingham story. And
we talk about that case a lot.
And that story to me, just reading it, just reading a synopsis of it, just kind of made me go in and read more and turn more pages and just, you know, just learn what I learned about his case. And then there were others. And I went on and subsequent to that, most recently, and this is what really kind of got me deep rooted and dug in. I was in Austin, Texas, and there's a case involving Rodney Reed. It's Rodney Reed. He's currently on death row right now. And I was invited to a documentary, and it's the state versus, it was a showing of the state versus Rodney Reed. And, you know, in advance of going to the event, I read, did my homework. I met with the group that was facilitating that activity, the Campaign to End the Death Penalty. That's the name of the organization. And so we sat there for 60 minutes, and we watched and listened to, you know, whereas you have this man that's on death row now, and you talk about all these expert people that have come in and have talked about, you know, why his case is very compelling. His case is before the Innocence Project right now. And after the event was over, a lot of us stayed around and we spoke with Miss Sandra Reed. That's his mother, and his brother Roderick Reed, and very compassionate woman about the plight of her son. As best she can, she's trying to get the word out. And so, Ray, from my standpoint, you know, there's currently a petition. They've signed 9,000 people on Mr.
Yeah,
Reed's
behalf. Signed the petition. Came over my rental.
And so, just trying my best to learn more, educate, because oftentimes from.
Let me ask you this, Duane. Do you think there's anything unique about you, or are there other people out there that, if they just know, would be committed?
And that's a very good question. In this, going back to Cameron Todd Willingham, you know, when you're at lunch or at dinner, in my case, I was at dinner and I came across a guy and we were waiting to be seated, and he, small talk conversation as you and I are sitting here right now, and it led to, what do you do for a living? I explained to him, and I was waiting for that, you know, that 12 o'clock pause, you know, to pull back. And I mentioned Cameron Todd's case, and he said, oh, I know that case. He said, I know that case very well. I was living in the area at the time that it occurred. And I said, well, these things have happened. This is information that has been forthcoming, you know, new scientific evidence, if you will, refutes junk science evidence. And he said, Duane, I followed that case until I moved to Colorado. To answer your question, I think that people, if you broached him about the subject matter, and you're informative and you have the information thereof, I think people will be willing participants and yield to your voice and hear what you have to say and not be so defensive up front, so to speak. And so in my, you know, efforts to talk with people, I talk from the standpoint of just a common sense perspective, a general layperson's perspective, not trying to talk over their head, reach them where they are. And in doing so, I likewise try to reciprocate the conversation whereby I'm not the one that's overwhelming or overbearing with them. I try to have common discourse with them whereby we have common accord, but for the most part, it's a good general conversation.
Thank you, Duane. On 2 days' notice, you've come down here and I've grilled you, and you've done a beautiful job. Fellows, you heard the hope in that message. And sometimes I forget that I'm talking to a free world audience in this country or in Europe or wherever you're from. And I only think about the boys on death row. I can't reach the women on death row. They're out of broadcast. So I spent a lot of time leaning and talking to them. And I wanted to bring Duane Bennett in to let him tell you a story that you're never really alone. There are people who care here. May be difficult for some of you individually to find it, but it might change your attitude if you knew they exist. And thank you for existing, Duane.
Thank you for having me.
All right. We have not heard anything back from Huntsville. We have not heard, this is an inordinately long time to pass without anything from Huntsville, but I'm going to swing over to Jack and let Jack tell us his piece of the story.
Well, I'm here to talk about the lesser included charges that can come with a capital murder charge. Lesser included in a capital murder is kind of a funny thing. It's like this. If I rob somebody, and in the process of robbing them, I murder somebody, then it's a capital murder. Meaning, if I intend to do something bad, but I never intended to kill someone, but oops, I did, that's a cap. I can get the death penalty. On the other hand, if I wanted to kill somebody, killed them, and then figured, what the hell, they're dead, I might as well take their money, then I'm guilty of felony murder, not capital murder. In other words, the law as it stands favors you if you're really cold-blooded. The punchline to this is that with a felony murder charge, you can get a probation, whereas in capital murder, you cannot. So this lesser included distinction is important when you're picking a jury. And this actually came into play in Doyle's case. If you can get the court to consider felony murder, you can get rid of a lot of jurors who might be more likely to execute. It's like this. In order to get onto a jury for capital murder, you have to be able to assess punishment of life in prison or death. Most people would be okay with that range of punishment. It's fairly narrow, and once they find somebody guilty of murder, they already don't like you. So, but if you introduce felony murder into the range of punishment, you now have to consider everything from 10 years of probation to death. That's a much, much wider range than capital murder. Fewer people are going to be okay with probation once they find you guilty of murder. So these are what you have left are people who are more flexible. And these are the people you want if you're the defendant. If you can get people onto the jury who are okay with that, your chances are much better of not being executed.
But isn't the prosecutor going to object to your introducing felony murder into
the
case?
Oh, sure. But the funny thing about felony murder is that all you have to do is raise some scintilla of evidence that of felony murder, and then it gets and the court has to consider it.
Ray, that way that normally works, because you haven't heard the evidence during the jury selection. So if ahead of time they're going to have a hearing to see if there's going to be some evidence of a lesser included defense as a predicate to being able to voir dire on the 10 years probation. Because when you're doing you don't know what the evidence, you're going to be able to get that charge during the jury selection. But
the only people that know the evidence are actually the lawyers.
Exactly.
Then they go to the judge with their conflict.
Because what will happen, let's say that I'm going to voir dire on felony murder in a capital murder case. The state's going to object, and I've got to come forward to show some proof that I can get that jury charge based on the evidence. That's how that works.
Wow. Okay.
Neat stuff. And this is, it's real clever. And this is exactly what Doyle's attorney did. It's real, real clever. Doyle's trial attorney was able to get the felony murder charge considered by the court. So among the juror, and this is where the objection to the jurors comes up. Among the jurors, there were two folks who Doyle complained about on his jury. The first was Allen, and the second was Goldsmith. The objection to Allen, I think, is a lot stronger. When Allen was asked questions, he would waffle back and forth as to whether he could give the entire range of punishment. And remember, now the range of punishment is from 10 years probation all the way to death. When the judge or the prosecutor would ask him the questions, no problem. He didn't have any problems with giving probation. But when Doyle's trial attorney asked the questions, he started to waffle back and forth and say, yeah, you know, it seems like he would have trouble with probation. I mean, it just seems like a really light sentence for taking a life. But despite despite Allen waffling back and forth, the jury ended up allowing Allen to be on the jury. The second juror Doyle complained about was Goldsmith. I think this is really an objection as to whether or not you believe Goldsmith or not. Goldsmith's in the background. Goldsmith was asked, you know, have you had experience with, you know, have you had anybody murdered in your family? She said, yes, her grandfather was murdered when he owned a liquor store, and his killer was eventually sentenced to death. At the time, Goldsmith was 3 years old. Her mother, who was 33 years old at the time, ended up having a nervous breakdown because her father was shot and killed. The question she was asked was whether she could be fair and whether she could assess the entire range of punishment from probation all the way to death. She didn't flinch. There was no question. She said, "Oh yes, I can do that." It didn't matter who asked. And you know, I think what we're looking at here is somebody who's gone through this kind of an experience. Can they really be objective? If it's a family member that you knew.
Is anybody in this room practice any courts martial?
Not that I know of. Jack Zimmerman does
okay,
all that.
Okay, let me tell you something. I was on a panel recently, and a law professor who had spent his entire legal career practicing in courts martial said that part of the charge of every sentence in a courts martial is to the jury assess. Charge. The jury is charged. Jury, of course, military personnel. Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody's a soldier there. So this other theory does not exist. But said they are charged before they go away and deliberate, assess the lowest possible sentence consistent with the facts of this case. Nothing like that happens in criminal court.
No, not at all.
Let me tell you what you're doing, Kate. The real problem with George, jury selection, Ray, how are we doing on time, by the way?
I'm going to alert Elizabeth. Elizabeth, would you call Huntsville and see if there's been any? Would you call Ms. Epstein and see if there's been
any? Yes, I just spoke with Kelly, and she said no witnesses have come out yet.
You know, this is now 6:47, and the jury started on time shortly after 6 o'clock went in there. The witness is not going to come out until the person being executed is dead. And for that process to take this long is horrendous. Maybe we do need to know more about who makes these chemicals. And do they know what the hell they're doing in the process of using their pharmaceuticals to murder people? I think that's important. So we've got another 10 minutes of show to do here.
Let me make a suggestion to you, because the worst thing you do when you're picking a juror is having that vacillating juror. With the state, he can say, I can consider the range of punishment. With you, says he can't. Let me make, you know, somebody who's had a real bad experience, let me make some suggestions, some lawyers who got faced with this problem. In this case where you had a lady whose grandfather had been killed,
Goldsmith
had someone like that, you ask her this question. If you had a loved one on trial, would you prefer to have somebody who had someone in their family killed by capital murder or someone who had not had that experience? Get her to say, well, I would prefer somebody who served on the jury who didn't have that experience, and ask her why. Get her, not you, to admit that there may be a possibility of bias. Get her to say, well, if I would prefer someone who had never had that experience, you ask her, why would you prefer that? And her answer is going to be obvious. Well, I'd prefer someone who'd never gone through what I'd gone through. And you ask her, why would you prefer that? Are you worried? And what you do, never, ever use the word bias, because nobody wants to admit bias. Here's what you say. You say, isn't it a possibility that real bad experience you went through could bleed over and spill and spoil your otherwise good judgment? And don't you think there may be other cases you can serve on? You could be more fair. And then you say, let's do it this way. Assuming that your son's on trial for capital murder, would you want somebody who's gone through your experience, having somebody killed in your family and being reminded about that, sitting on this juror? Would you prefer someone with your frame of mind sitting on the jury to judge someone that you love dearly? And what you're trying to do, the key in cases like that, you never want to tattle a juror their bias. You show situations where they probably could not be objective. And then once they say they could be biased, and you've got to wire them in and say that, and they start vacillating, say, now here's the deal. We've got a death penalty case at stake. Wouldn't you agree with me? It's better to err on the side of caution Because you get back in the jury room, it's too late to say.
Too late to say it.
So what you do,
you're selected,
exactly.
You're selected, yeah.
What you say to that juror, wouldn't you agree with me, it better, much be better to err on the side of caution and say, I just simply can't do it.
Jim, how many juries in capital cases have you selected as a prosecutor and as a defense lawyer?
Probably about 10.
And that's a full career.
Yeah, and well, that's...
10 capital juries is
a
lifetime.
See, that's the nightmare because... What will happen when you get a juror that bounces back and forth, you've got to kind of really get down with them and put it how they would feel. Well, they want someone like, I'll give you a good example. Years ago when they were trying remember the Indian big deal up there? One of the problems I had was Indian bias, and John Ackerman was picking the jury. And they had a rancher's wife, and all ranchers hated Indians, and he knew that. And so what John said, would you give me some experience? She said she had no bias, blah, blah, blah. He said, would you give me the last experience you had with a Native American? And she thought for a moment, and she said, well, one day when it was raining, I let him stand under the shed of the barn. And since, my God, how she treat him like dogs. And she just admitted. And then she said to herself, once she said that, you know, you're absolutely right. I'm not fair with those people. But you've got to get down to that point where they say that someone like them would make a judgment on somebody you love. And that's how you handle that bias thing. And then once you get on bouncing, then you say, wouldn't you agree with me that since this is a serious case, it means loss of liberty, it means loss of life. Wouldn't you agree with me the better thing to do is to err on the side of caution? That'd be fair.
I think we've got a telephone call. Okay. Elizabeth, is it time? She's talking, and we may have word from Huntsville. No, she's still on the phone, so I can't talk to her.
Well, I was just going to tell you that they're coming out. The media is coming out. It looks like there may or may not have been one or two family members. We just simply can't tell.
But the media is just now coming out?
They are just now, as we speak, they're coming out.
Well, now, this began pretty much on schedule, and here it is, 6:51. That is an enormously inordinate length of time for an execution to take.
Yes. When they changed the protocol, they began taking, 30 to 35 minutes.
No.
This is one of the longer times. They went in at 3 minutes after six, and they're just this minute coming out. So it's an extra 15, 20 minutes.
Well,
terrible.
I want to thank you, Kelly, for your service.
Oh, you're welcome, Ray.
And you have certainly informed us of something that we're all thinking about. I began the show by announcing that the lawyers for two people that are scheduled to be executed now have not only the name of that drug, but who made it. And I think that may be the result of some writs coming pretty quickly. Thank you, sister.
Yes, just Mr. Hernandez's sister is here tonight. She is planning on being here the next 2 weeks until we know what's going to happen with her brother.
We'll give her
on the 9th.
Give her our love and tell her to tell her brother that we will cover that show.
I'll do that, Ray. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Jim, it worries me, this passage of time.
Yeah, because, you know, back when they were using that three-drug cocktail, we would just have someone go in within a matter of 10 minutes, they'd be coming out.
Sure.
And now we're talking about going in at what, almost up at right 6, and it's almost an hour.
And this is at least 50 minutes.
Now, that means he's not been pronounced dead until they came out.
Until they come out.
Exactly.
Jack, did you get through with your saga?
I did. The only thing I would add is that, not surprisingly, the judge allowed both of the jurors on. And much to the credit of the defense attorney, he did in fact perfect the objection. He asserted a clear and specific challenge for cause. He also he had also used all his peremptory challenges that he on the complaint of people that he was talking about.
So the appellate lawyer had something to work with. That just didn't work either.
No, he really didn't. And the reason is that the appellate courts really don't like to question what trial judges decide. And in this case, the trial judge decided, you know, these jurors, no bias. Or in the case of Goldsmith, I believe her that she can be impartial and she can assess the entire range.
Well, Thank you all for a wonderful show. I miss a woman's voice this week.
Well, we tried to get Sharon, but she got shot.
We did get some of our reporters come in. I want to thank Kelly Epstein. I want to thank Dave Atwood. I want to thank Dwayne Bennett for coming in and giving us some insight from a lay caring person's perspective. And, of course, our attorneys, Jim Skelton, Larry Douglas, Michael Gillespie, and Jack Lee did their usual wonderful work. And the music we play on here was composed by the sister of a death row inmate, Ms. Panetti, who has gone to the trouble of writing a series of music we use as a theme. Our producer, without whom we could do very little, is Elizabeth Stein, for preparing all these notes so that I can make sense without stumbling enormously. I want to mention, of course, that we appreciate the good offices of Otis McClay for doing wonderful work on our website. It's just improved if you haven't been there recently. And who we got on the board tonight?
Ann,
and there's that woman's voice I promised you. Thank you, Ann, for doing this tonight.
Oh, thank you.
And thank you very much for listening to Execution Watch. Our next time to visit will be with Tommy Wells, and I have an interview in front of me that we made with Tommy on Texas Death Row. It's a little long, but he's got a lot of important things to say. So we will be back in here 1 week hence, the 3rd of April, a Thursday.